The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with Kia Credit. Flexible 142 finance solutions from Kia, home of the 7-year warranty.
John at RTE.ie.
Our text number is 51551. Our email address, john at RTE.ie. Now, Val McDermid is a prolific writer of fiction, and her main concern is crime. During her career, she has often spoken to the experts on policing and forensics to get the detail just right. And now she has written a factual book on the subject. It's called Forensics, The Anatomy of Crime, and it's published by Profile Books. Val McDermid, good morning.
Good morning.
And on this occasion, Val, why fact instead of fiction?
Well, I was actually approached to do the book by the Wellcome Collection, who have a magnificent medical museum in central London. And they're having a big refurb at the moment, and they were planning to reopen with a big forensics exhibition. And they wanted a book that would sit alongside the exhibition. It's not a catalogue of the exhibition, but it's something that I suppose adds to what people can go and see. It deepens the knowledge of what's on display.
And was it a daunting task to undertake this?
It was. My first response to it was to say, no, I can't do this. I'm not a scientist. I just make stuff up. But we talked about it, and eventually we came up with a format that I thought I could work with, which was that I would go and interview experts in various aspects of forensic science and then sort of fit that into the history and practice of the discipline.
Yes, and you recognise in the book the debt of the crime writer to forensics.
Absolutely. I think, and of course, in the last 20 years, forensics has galloped forward at an alarming rate, and it has become incumbent upon us to try and stay abreast of at least the headline aspects of the science. Of course, because all the readers are well-versed in this because they watch true crime programmes, they watch documentaries about forensics, they watch programmes like CSI, which are a kind of science fiction of forensics, but they all have a pretty strong idea of what goes on at a crime scene.
Mm. And you use the killing of a policewoman, Sharon Beshinevsky, as a kind of test case in the book to explain what the different stages are. Why did you choose that particular case?
I chose the case almost because the case chose me. I was talking to Peter Arnold, who is a crime scene manager in a big forensic crime scene conglomerate in the north of England, and I asked him, what's the case that most sticks in your mind that has been most of a milestone for you in your career? And he said without hesitation, Sharon Beshinevsky. Now, it was a case that I was aware of because it was a case that grabbed the headlines. Sharon was a serving police officer who was shot in the line of duty while trying to stop an armed robbery in progress. And what I hadn't realised, I think, at the time was that the degree to which the solution of the crime relied on the application of various sorts of forensic science. So there was everything there from DNA to ballistics to the sort of ANPR, the number plate recognition cameras. So it became a sort of one of these cases that pulls together lots of aspects of forensics, and therefore, to me, writing the book was very interesting.
And what exactly happened to Sharon Beshinevsky?
Well, as I say, she was out on patrol with her colleague, and they got a call that a travel agent was being robbed in the centre of Bradford. And they drove to the scene, and as they got out of the car, the robbers were leaving this travel agency where they had trussed up the staff and pistol-whipped them and threatened them to get them to hand over the contents of the safe. Sharon and her colleague tried to stop the men from leaving, and a gun was pulled and they were both shot, and Sharon died at the scene and her colleague was seriously wounded. The robbers made their getaway, but some witnesses were able to identify the kind of car they were in, and so it then became possible to look at number plate recognition cameras and road cameras around the city and narrow down the car that the men were driving, and then it was possible to map out sort of key points along the route that the car had followed as it made its way back down south. They were able to establish that it had gone into a particular service area and bought some items there, like sort of soft drinks and snack food. Because of the number plate recognition it was possible very quickly to trace where the car had come from. It was a hire car. And the police in London picked the car up within 24 hours of the shooting. But the men that they picked, who were driving the car when they picked it up, were not involved in the robbery. So then it became a question of finding out who these men were who had committed the robbery. And there was forensic evidence in the car because, fortunately for us, criminals are not always very tidy people. And they'd just drunk their soft drinks and eaten their snacks and just dropped their stuff all over the car. So there was DNA was extracted from that, and that led them to the killers. And eventually it resulted in a satisfactory court case. Not satisfactory for Sharon Beshnevsky and her family, obviously, but it did give some closure to the police officers who had worked with Sharon and knew her over the years.
At least the perpetrators were tracked down. Incidentally, what is the footwear database, Val?
Is a database of different kinds of patterns of soles on shoes. You know, trendy trainers, you know, young people have to have a particular make of trainers, but even particular brands of trainers within the range have many different sole designs. And so there exists a database of these footwear soles, and the guys who manage the database have, you know, maintained contact with shoe manufacturers. So whenever a new design comes out, they add that to the database. So when a footprint is discovered at a scene, the officer concerned can go to the database and see if it exists on the database. That way they can sometimes link a series of crimes together. If you've got a set of crimes that have some similarities in the same geographical area and there's a footprint that's been seen several of those crimes, you can say with some degree of confidence that that same perpetrator committed those crimes. So when you eventually end up with a suspect and you go to their house and they've got that shoe and it matches all those footprints, you've got them linked to a whole series of crimes.
I'm just wondering about the cost to the people involved in all of this. They obviously see some pretty gruesome things, and there must be some personal cost.
I think there is. I think that there's a great camaraderie builds up between people who work in this field, police officers, paramedics, firefighters, and forensic scientists. There's a lot of mutual support goes on. People learn very quickly that they can talk to their colleagues in a way that they can't talk to anybody outside the business, if you like. It's not something where you can go home and you know, your family says to you, "What did you do at work today, Mummy?" And you can tell them, because most of the stuff that you do is not easily explicable to, particularly to young children. My friend Sue Black, who's a forensic anthropologist, who's been involved in quite a lot of mass grave excavations in places like Iraq and Kosovo, was doing a radio interview on one occasion after she'd come back from Iraq, and she was talking about the helicopter that she was in having been shot at and brought down, no loss of life or serious injury or anything. But she was talking about this on the radio, and when she went home that night, her younger daughter said to her, "I don't want you going back there, Mummy. I'm frightened." And she said it just hadn't crossed her mind when she was telling the story that her child would be listening, and that this would have that effect. And in fact, she hasn't done one of those cases since then.
Interesting. And you were a reporter, Val, when the Stardust fire happened in Dublin back in 1981. And you go into some detail in the book about it. Why so?
Well, it was one of those odd coincidences, really. I was interviewing Niamh McDade, who is a professor of chemistry, but as an expert in fire and explosions. And Niamh got into the business of fire and explosions because that's what both of her parents did. They were fire investigators. And again, I said to Niamh, "What's the case that sticks in your head most vividly?" And she said, "Well, it's not really one of my cases, but it was my mother's case." And she said, "Stardust fire, Stardust disco fire." And immediately I was transported back to my own early days in national newspapers. And that phone call in the middle of the night, summoning me to the airport to go off to Dublin to report on the horrors of that night.
And what are your recollections of that time?
I spent most of that day out in Coolock interviewing the families of the bereaved. And I suppose what I remember most is the dignity of the people who had lost their children. They were all still, I think, in shock, but there was no sort of unseemly outbreaks, if you like, of sentiment or anger. There was just a real quiet, honest dignity that I came upon that day, and it was very moving. I was principally interviewing the bereaved, collecting photographs of their dead teenagers, and it was a difficult job. That's never an easy job. It's never a pleasant job. And I remember also going back to the site of the fire later in the day. And the extraordinary thing was that because of the way the fire had burned, it burned, as it were, from the inside out. As you stood in the street, there was almost nothing to tell you that the fire had been there apart from the smell. If you could have blocked your nose, it looked almost untouched. It was very strange.
Mm. And I presume one of the reasons for highlighting it in the book is to highlight the changes that have happened since 1981.
Yes, there's a lot of advance has been made in the exploration of fires and their origins and what happens. And of course, what was also interesting with the Stardust is because there were so many sort of different inquiries, and eventually the evidence was adduced. At first, the experts thought one thing had happened because they didn't have the full details in front of them. But gradually, over the years, more and more information emerged until it was possible to build a very different picture of what had actually happened that night. And so from that point of view, that was also interesting to see the way that the progress of how we interpret the knowledge that we have has changed in the light of new understanding.
And Val, in the book, you've also a very tasteful chapter, let's call it, on forensic entomology, insects. tell us about insects.
Insects really like a good meal. The guy I spoke to there is a guy called Martin Hall, who is a curator at the Natural History Museum in London. And he's one of these experts who has a great passion for his subjects and an extraordinary breadth and depth of knowledge and the sort of eagerness to share that knowledge. You know, something like 30 million specimens of different kinds of fly at the Natural History Museum.
Lovely.
And I think he knows every single one of them. But he took me up into the absolute pinnacle of the museum. It's a northwest tower up an endless flight of stone stairs where he and his colleagues conduct their experiments. He pointed to some what looked like ordinary carry-on suitcases in the corner of the room, and he said that might look to you like something you'd just take on a plane with you, but a few weeks ago they were filled with pig's heads. And I'm like, why? Why do you have a suitcase full of a pig's head? So we needed to find out what flies can lay their eggs through the zip of a case.
Lovely.
So that if body parts are found in a suitcase, we can tell which flies will have been there and when they'll have been there. Because not all flies arrive at the same time. There's a very definite sequence and a time frame in which different flies come to do their bits of consumption.
I see.
Again, as I say, he's a man with great passion.
You'd want to have a little bit of passion for your work to go through all of that.
Oh, I think so. He's got these sort of different boxes of pupating maggots at different stages as well. You know, when he produced his lunchtime sandwiches in the same sort of Tupperware box, I have to say, I wasn't overly keen to accept his offer of a sandwich.
You recoiled in horror. Val, you also dedicate a whole chapter in the book to pathology. You'd certainly make for an interesting dinner party guest, I reckon.
Well, I think an awful lot of the things that I know about are not things that you particularly want to share with people over a meal. I think, you know, the pathology is fascinating because, of course, you know, so many of our secrets are unveiled after death. The pathologist and the anthropologist can now tell us so many things that people may not necessarily want the rest of the world to know. The anthropologists, for example, now can tell all sorts of extraordinary details. There's a bone in your ear, for example, that when analysed can reveal where your mother was living when she was pregnant with you.
Extraordinary.
Now, you know, there's. I mean, of course, as a writer of crime fiction, my ears immediately prick up at something like that, and I think, how can I use that? How can I make that a telling detail in the story? Why would someone be lying about where they were when their child was born? So right away, you know, I'm alive to the possibilities.
And you go into great detail on blood, on genetic fingerprinting, on many other aspects of forensics. Is there, do you think, a single most important development, or is it a combination of all the different developments there have been over the years? Do you have a favourite, in other words?
I think that... because of all the different developments, it's hard to pick on something in particular. But I'm interested in DNA. I'm interested in the progression where we went from, you know, needing a blood stain the size of a 50p to get any DNA result to now being able to get a DNA result from sort of microscopic quantities of bodily fluids, and the implications that has for innocent contamination of people's clothing and items by DNA. You know, now this is a situation where, you know, if we went out to the pub together for the evening and you put your arm around me to give me a big hug at the end of the evening and maybe a wee kiss underneath my ear, you go away with my DNA all over you. I get murdered that night, and I of course have your DNA on my body as well. So they come looking for you. Because in spite of the fact that our contact was perfectly innocent, we have each other's DNA, going back to Lockhart's principle. So there are a lot of possibilities for innocent presence of DNA that's now analysable that didn't used to be. And I find that slightly worrying, slightly concerning. Mm-hmm. But the other aspect of forensics, I think, that I personally find really fascinating, because I am a geek monkey, is the digital forensics. What those guys can do now seems to me to be little short of magic, and I just love hearing the guy that is my forensic expert in digital stuff, Angus Marshall. I love hearing him telling me what they can now do in that sort of very creepy Big Brother is watching you, or is he, kind of way.
And Val, you mentioned earlier on CSI. What is the CSI effect?
Well, it's questionable how to what extent it's real, but there is a theory that juries in particular are contaminated in a way by what they see on CSI, that the guys on CSI can apparently work all sorts of miracles in no time flat, and people believe this is how it really is. And so when the prosecution can't actually produce that kind of detailed forensic evidence, because basically it doesn't exist, or basically the techniques are just not available to them, then people are troubled by the absence of forensic detail. And I think sometimes there is an expectation that particularly with murder cases, you'll get all this all singing, all dancing array of forensic evidence, fibre evidence, DNA evidence, when actually all you need is the fingerprint and blood. Sometimes the simple answer is the correct answer, and you don't need to bother with all the other sophisticated stuff.
Val, thanks a million for joining us this morning. The book is called Forensic, The Anatomy of Crime, and it's published by Profile Books. Val McDermott, good morning and take care.
Thanks a lot. John at rte.ie.